Today we're talking about a couple. This is not your average insights. A couple things have happened. One is the Fed has held tight on dropping interest rates, even though they have been signaling that they want to be doing this for a long time. Number two is the youngins are out there in droves talking about something. They're not super pumped about our boy Dave Ramsey and the advice that he gives. There's been a generational backlash on social media. If you put in hashtag Dave Ramsey on TikTok, you're not going to find very good things. We're going to talk about why this is happening and why this is kind of a, even though we're not Gen Z, we're used to this conversation of like the backlash that's happening from this advice. So we're going to dive into that in today's edition of Not Your Average Insights. Welcome to the number one place you should send anyone trying to get out of the rat race and build a little wealth. When you're building your portfolio, starting from the ground floor, you need something different that you never thought you'd have before. A rabbit in the hat called the Not Your Average Investor Show to inspire you, entertain you, and teach you how to grow your dough. Surrounded by a tribe with a vibe you've been seeking for, with people in your corner gonna make you really, really grow. But just how fast you'll grow, how big you'll go, you couldn't possibly know. Not at this point in time, but that's why we're here. Welcome to the Not Your Average Investor Show and Community, where we figured that most of us trying to get out of the rat race need a little bit of education and a lot of friends to help us understand complicated asset classes. And that's what we provide here, with a focus on helping you get into one of the greatest long-term risk-adjusted asset classes in the history of investments: rental income properties. But don't hear from me. Join us right now to our live show, already in progress. Enjoy. Welcome, everybody, to the Tuesday edition of the Not to your weekly edition of the Not Your Average Investor Show. I'm your host, Pablo Gonzalez, and with me, as always, is the man that I affectionately like to call GC because of his generational concepts.
All right, we'll do that.
Because he's got genius concepts, because he knows how to generate cash flow, because he's a great co-host, and because his name is Greg Cohen. Say hello, Greg.
Hello, everybody. Great to be with you.
And it is good to be here in studio, GC. You are back from a little trip that you took.
I did. I did just come back. It was one of those bucket list trips that really pisses off my boy here because it has with, you know, the thing that I love to do beyond family and beyond hanging out at the Not Your Average Investor Show. Then it's golf for me, baby. And I got to go to Scotland and play golf at some of the most prestigious courses in the country, in the world. Bucket list material. I got to play the old course at St. Andrews. I got to play two or three other courses that are like, I put together my top five and top 10 list of all the golf courses that I've played. Definitely three of them in the top five. So yeah, did it for a week. When do you get to go? Like, listen, I've got a beautiful wife and two kids at home. When do you get to go a week and just go play golf with your buddies? So super appreciate my family. And it was pretty awesome, man.
I just want to say it doesn't upset me at all that you go to Scotland to play golf. Because you can take our time away from us here at the Not Your Average Investor together, but you can never take our freedom.
Well done. All right, well done.
Had to go Braveheart on that
there
one.
There we go. It was ringing very loudly and clearly there for those 7 days for me in Scotland.
I would assume that you guys were like, hold. Yep. Anyways, so we can do Braveheart.
I did play Robert the Bruce course, by the way.
Robert the Bruce.
Yeah.
Robert the Bruce course. That's fascinating. I'm pumped you got to have that, man. I do miss you when we're not doing this together. And the whole golf thing, you know, it's not about you. It's more just like I'm mad at my dad that he stopped playing tennis when I reach the moment that I might be able to give him a shot to play golf, and therefore I have forever villainized golf, and I really just...
It's taken us 400 episodes to get this out here in the open here. You could have done this on episode four.
All right, welcome, everybody. We have a little tradition that we like to kick this show off with, don't we, GC?
Yes, we do.
What's that called?
It's called the roll call, baby.
All right, we got the MVP kicking us off
today. Mr. Lee Bishop.
Everybody knows Lee Bishop. We got the mother nana.
Bill Green.
He just says high MVP, Billy.
What we chop liver here?
Big mistake. I mean, not trying to just talking to the MVP. I get it. Everybody wants to be friends with the MVP. We got the leadoff hitter batting third today.
John Henning.
We got Christopher Lee from Fernandina Beach.
All right, Chris.
We got Pamela Myers from Washington State.
All right, Pamela.
Checking in, Pamela. We got our regulars, Gary and Rosalind Riley from Marietta, California.
We regard you.
Okay, so Billy Green has his good morning from the bullishly bearish mountains of Colorado. Thank you, Billy.
He's going easy on you now.
We got the mystery man and mystery lady.
Denny Davies and his wonderful wife, Erica.
Good to have you in the house, Denny. We got the Shaman.
Nadim Shah.
With his trademark, good morning, good afternoon from the West Coast. We got Pedro Nacianceno from
Jersey.
We got Charity Graham checking in with us. Charity,
hey,
welcome
Charity.
Back. Good to have you. We got Laura Colby from Washington State.
All right, Laura.
Excited for this topic. Tell me more, Laura.
Now we're talking.
Are you a Ramsey lover or a Ramsey hater?
Ooh.
Are you Gen Z? Or Jen Me. I don't know how to make that run. We got Zenobia Lewis from Stone Mountain, Georgia.
New name. All right. Welcome to the party.
Show. Good to have you. I've heard beautiful things about Stone Mountain. Want to check that out. Who else we got in here? We got the Mama Bear in the house.
Cody Adams.
We got Big Papa in the house. We love it when he calls it Big Papa.
All right, my man. Pops, how are you, buddy?
The co-founder of the co-founder, Greg's dad, Jay Cohen. Good to have you in here. We got our amigo from Miami.
Luis Olivares. Great to see you, Luis. He's been showing up each and every show, I feel like. Luis, it's great to have you.
From Venezuela, living down in Miami. That's awesome. Good to have him. We got Kevin O'Brien.
All right, Kevin. Good to see you, my friend.
He loves the Scotland golf.
I knew Kevin would love Scotland golf.
Kevin does, even though I'm not sure that the Irish are that big a fan of the Scottish historically.
Listen, that's the beautiful thing about golf. We're all in the past. One big happy family.
It's all in the past. Who else we got in here? We got Mark Norman checking in with hello.
All right, Mark.
Mark, good to have you here. When are we having the JWB tournament is what Luis is asking. In
The JWB like golf tournament in Scotland is he's talking about?
I think so.
Because we do have the JWB charity golf tournament we just had. Maybe we could take it, you know, to Scotland. Maybe
we got the five Fs in the house. Our favorite fiduciary fee-based financial advisor friend.
Kelly Barenbaum.
Haven't seen you in a minute, Kelly. Good to have you. We got the number nine most attended shows last year.
She's working on that.
She's working on it.
She's going to be way up on the top 10 list this year.
Misty Intro Johnson from Denver. Johnson. Good to have you in here. Who else we got in here? We got Connie Stamos from Altadena, California.
Connie,
Altadena.
Welcome. Get it right.
I'm sorry. I was like Atlanta, Pasadena, Altadena, California.
All right, Connie, welcome.
Is Connie a new name?
I don't think so.
Because it sounds familiar.
But we are just as excited because Connie doesn't always show up. So it's great to see you, Connie.
Good to have you. We got Juan Jose Lopez.
All right, Juan. Very nice.
JJ from Ojai.
All right. Love JJ.
JJ Ojai. Oh, hi, JJ. I know how to say Juan. I don't know how to say oh, hi. So that's just my thing. And of course, we got the first family. Ken and Carolyn, Malene, Patrick and Matriarch.
We salute you.
Diane Jaquez, first time from Concord, Massachusetts.
All right, Diane. Welcome to the show.
Or Jacques. I said Jaquez because I'm already from Ohio. Diane Jacques.
Listen, your countryman Luis is probably just so embarrassed with you right now. Just your J's and your Jotas. Come on, get it right.
There you go. Ojai Luna in Chumash language.
Oh, wow.
Oh, it means moon.
Oh, fantastic.
Oh, hello.
All right.
Okay, enough about us. Enough about the roll call. Good to have the community in the house. As always, checking in with us. You are what makes this show great. GC, let's talk. I want to get into the generational backlash against Mr. Ramsey. But I think the first thing we want to talk about that just happened recently, the Fed just had their meeting. They've been signaling all year that they want to do, three rate cuts throughout the year. Mm-hmm. We know that they want to do rate cuts, and yet they got together and decided no rate cut this time around. What do you have to say about that? What's going on?
I think it's funny because the more that everybody is certain that something's going to happen in regards to the Fed or the economy, the less likely it is to happen. You've seen that. There was a lot of talk that, listen, it's an inverted yield curve. There's all of these things that were showing us that it was definitely going to be a recession, and that recession hasn't happened, right? Mm-hmm. The economy largely has continued to go full steam. And then in the beginning of this year, like you mentioned, there was all of this talk.
Well, don't forget about other guesses.
Yeah. Oh, well.
When interest rates would go up, and they would stay up. Real estate was going to crash.
Oh, yeah.
Don't
how far back do we want to go?
Everybody saw that coming. Right?
Yeah. How far back do we want to go there? We could do a whole show on not your average takes compared to the rest of the talking heads out there and how.
That would be an interesting show, actually.
We should, actually.
We've actually talked about that a lot.
All right.
I feel
let's
you have so many receipts now for the last, like, 4 years that
there,
it's enough.
There are receipts, right? The Not Your Average Investor Show receipts
Let's collect.
But, you know, early this year, Jerome Powell, and the chairman said, listen, we're expecting rate cuts to be happening. We're expecting three this year. And when he says something like that, that starts a serious momentum. And so people were expecting that rate cuts would start to happen. Maybe not exactly right now here, May 7th, but sometime very soon. And that, of course, hasn't happened. Why hasn't that happened? It's all about inflation. This inflation metric, which is measured by the consumer price index. That's the index. How much are the cost of a certain basket of goods going up year over year? This measurement is driving everything in our economy. And for those of us who have been investing for, you know, 20 years, consumer price index has always been important, but it hasn't gone to where it has been over the last year and a half, 2 years, where it raged up to 9%. 9.1% was the highest CPI that we've had and the highest that we've had in 40 years. And ever since that started to happen and get close to that 9% figure, that CPI metric has dominated the economic landscape. And we've been able as an economy to bring that number down. And the reason that it is important to bring that number down is because the entire economy is based on, you know, what goods and services are costing. And those who have the least are the most affected by a high inflation rate, along with everybody else in the economy. So it's a big deal for the Fed to get right and for our economy and our government to get right to make sure that we're taking care of our people. So that's on its way down, but it might be somewhat easy to bring it, not easy, but it's easier to bring it down from 9% maybe to 7%, maybe to 5%. Now we're at about 3.5%. And what Jerome Powell and the Fed have said is that our mandate is 2%, and that it is really hard for them to bring it down from 3.5% to 2%. And the other thing is that we don't really have tools. The Fed doesn't really have tools to know what lever to pull or push to get it from 3.5% to 2%. So what is the Fed trying to do? They are trying to thread a needle here. They're using very blunt tools to do it because it's the only tools that we have to be able to manage this thing. And until they start seeing a number of leading indicators starting to point in the direction that inflation is getting closer to 2%, they're just going to say, hey, listen, not doing anything, right? Inactivity is an okay thing in the mind of the Fed right now because there are some very big consequences. If they start to take action too soon and lower the Fed funds rate, which lowers interest rates indirectly across the economy, that could send the economy back into more of an inflationary environment.
High gear spending mode.
Yeah, it really could. And so you could be right back up at 4% and 5% inflation, which is really, really big consequences for the economy. But on the other side, if they don't take action quick enough, what could happen is they restrict the economy so much that it goes into recessionary time. And the Fed has a dual mandate. One mandate is to keep inflation at or near 2% CPI. The other mandate is to keep unemployment low. So when I say they're threading this needle, if they don't take action and lower the Fed funds rate early enough, because we have these blunt tools, it could be too late. And we could already be paving the path to recession, which means high unemployment. And so while they would solve one of their mandates, they might make it a lot more difficult, you know, to solve the other mandate. So we haven't seen these leading indicators start to line up and make sense for the Fed.
Yeah.
And that's why they're on the sidelines. And that's why we did not see any activity as far as the Fed funds rate decreasing, even though many people thought that it would near this time.
Yeah. And just to recap for folks that haven't been following it as closely as GC or myself and the rest of the community here, I think it was, you know, we started having this like red hot job market. Unemployment was like at an all-time low. Inflation started going up, right? So they started raising interest rates because they believe that in order they raise interest rates, that cools off the spending. There was talk about going into like a, you know, really triggering a recession to try to do this. It kind of blipped. We had a little bit of what we call a white collar recession at some point about a year ago, right? Where there was a bunch of tech layoffs, a bunch of marketing people in tech layoffs, right? We're kind of the tip of the spear there. So if you listen to LinkedIn, there was a massive recession because that's where those people like to talk, right? But what has happened has been the economy cooled a little bit by letting some folks go. Venture capital has slowed down, right? These like other ancillary parts. Companies went from having this like growth at all cost mentality to sustainable growth. And what has essentially happened is unemployment has stayed pretty low, right? It's still a very
historically low, 3.9%.
Yeah, 3.9%, historically low inflation rate. Velocity of homes being sold and bought has slowed down.
Sure.
Right? But prices for homes have stayed up, which everybody thought that the moment that you make the interest rates go up, prices would go down, right? So like we've been at this almost equilibrium point of view, a new kind of like level of equilibrium point, right? Where it's like inflation hasn't ticked up, it hasn't ticked down, employment hasn't ticked up, it hasn't ticked down for like a minute now. And while everyone wants to see interest rates drop because there's a whole bunch of people on the sideline wanting to buy more real estate, wanting to buy more homes and do all these kinds of things, the Fed has said that they want to do this because people are asking for it. Everybody's happier when money is cheap because things can happen for them easier. But they're seeing this thing. They're holding on saying, we think that the moment that we drop interest rates, there's going to be all this demand on the sideline that's going to jump into the pool and it's going to start driving transactions. It's going to drive prices up. And we're afraid that if we do this, inflation is going to kick back up again. So we're not low enough again to do that. Is that?
Yeah, that's really accurate. I mean, through all of, there have been certain things that have maybe slowed or quelled, but overall the economy has continued to hum.
Yeah.
Which is mind-boggling to everybody that interest rates and the Fed funds rate could be so high for so long and your GDP numbers are still growing. That's gross domestic product. That's everything that we produce as a country. Mm-hmm. That's how you measure recessions or growth and expansionary times. This economy was so hot back in the day that the Fed raised their Fed funds rate the fastest that they could, the fastest in 40 years, and our economy is still growing. So that's what they're concerned about is if they pull back, that it could grow. I mean, we talk about what happens in real estate. When interest rates go down, which we are expecting them to go down at some point because that's what the Fed is saying. Mm-hmm. What happens to mortgage applications when interest rates go down? Everybody starts to think about buying a house. And your interest rates don't have to go from 7% to 4%. You'll see mortgage rate applications start ticking up when it goes from 7% to 6.5%. Right. And when mortgage applications go up, there's more demand for housing. So given the same level of supply, if you have more demand, that means house prices go up. And we've shown this on the show over and over and over again, but the data is clear. Every home builder knows it, that when interest rates go down, home prices go up.
Yep.
When interest rates go down, home prices go up. So, and that's a microcosm of the entire economy as well, right? When interest rates go down, people have more money in their pockets at the end of the day, at the end of the month, they have more money, businesses have more money, and things can start to expand. So the Fed is very leery of that, and they're just seeing different measurements. Like, for example, yesterday or a few days ago, the jobs report was released, and the jobs number came in lower than expected. Well, this is just such a weird time for us because what we're all actually rooting for is lower job numbers.
Yeah.
Like, when have we said that as an economy? Because what lower job numbers mean is that there's less wage increases for those job numbers. I know it's not popular to say that we don't want wages to increase, but when you think about the effect of inflation and CPI, wages going up lead to inflationary times. And so low job numbers, not seeing huge wage increases, is actually helping the inflation number come down. So it's just a topsy-turvy world that we live in right now.
It's a weird thing to think.
Yeah. Right?
That's what we're – that's definitely not what we want, right?
That's not what we want.
We want wages to go
up. We just want to go back to the way things used to be, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know what I hear, GC, is I hear – like I think we've been saying this message for a while. We've been talking about how, hey, prices are not going to drop on real estate.
Right.
Right? Because prices are going to continue to rise on real estate. And we know that when – interest rates go down, prices are going to go up, right? Like that's been proven. And I think people are starting to understand that. And I think people are making a, I don't know if I want to call it a cardinal sin, but it feels like because people know that they're trying to time the market and get everything that they want, it feels like there's a whole bunch of latent demand on the sideline that's waiting. Hey, as soon as interest rates go down, I'm going to jump in so I can get these prices that haven't gone up as much as they used to, but I want to do it at this new rate.
Yeah.
And what we continue to say is that once you're doing that, once you are doing getting greedy when everybody else is greedy, it's going to be too late. Like if you are waiting to buy real estate right now, you're waiting for that interest rate to drop, you're doing what everybody else is doing. You're moving at the pace of the Fed.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I think everyone's waiting for the Fed to make this decision to tell them what to do. But I've just never seen a good example of waiting for the government to tell you at what speed you need to move at the, for your business. Right? Like, and this whole demand that's on the sideline is waiting for this to happen. Instead of thinking like a not your average investor, instead of thinking, you know what, this idea that the rate's going to go down, I can use this to my advantage. I can get in right now with this price, with this rate, and then wait for the rate to go down and refinance later, as opposed to getting in once the thing starts going crazy again, which is what the Fed is trying to prevent.
Mm-hmm. This is the talking point of this year. Yeah. It is using this information to set yourself up for success in your real estate portfolio. And it's this knowledge that we're sharing that when interest rates go down, home prices go up, which has been documented over decades. We've shared the data on this on the show. So whereas it was a few years ago, we talked about the deal was the debt. And I was saying, guys, listen, interest rates were so low. Like you got to lock in right now.
Yeah.
You got to buy because interest rates are so low. This is the message for today, which is lock in right now, not because interest rates are so low right now, but because of what happens to pricing when interest rates come down. You are setting yourself up to buy and own real estate at a lower cost basis today. Because if you believe the data over decades that has shown that when interest rates go down, home prices go up, by locking in today at a higher interest rate, you're going to lock in for a lower price. And then it's not going to cost you much at all just to refinance. Yeah. So like this isn't even an idea of like being fearful or greedy, in my opinion. It's just a lack of understanding. It's a lack of knowledge.
Yeah.
Because in other countries, you don't have loans in place that you can just refinance without penalty.
Yeah.
In other countries, it costs you – you can't refinance. You have prepayment penalties. So like you really do, I don't ever believe in time in the market in real estate, to be quite honest, when it comes to single family buy and hold. But in other countries, you would have more of an incentive to do that just because the debt is so less favorable in other countries. Here in this country, you can buy it. The interest rate's higher today than you want, but all you do is you just refinance in 6 months, a year, 2 years. But now you probably save 10 grand, 20 grand, 30 grand, 50 grand of equity.
Of actual price.
Right, of actual price.
It. Yeah. It makes me think two things, GC. It makes me think we're so conditioned in other asset classes to buy the dip.
Right.
And that, it perverses our mentality for real estate because there's no dip in real estate. There's only like stable moments and then it goes up at faster rates. And to me, the equivalent of a dip in real estate is when interest rates are high and where prices are, because the moment that interest rates go low, it's going to rise, right? So like to me, the equivalent of buying the dip in real estate is buy right now when interest rates are high so that you can refinance the dip.
Yeah.
Right? Of interest rates.
I like that.
And
I
then
like
the that. Other part that I think about is like, unlike other asset classes, real estate is uniquely positioned in the sense that if what you're worried about is inflation, yeah, buy real estate.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? So like, why wouldn't you be like making this move right now? Why are people not having the clarity of mind of understanding that, listen, if the Fed is worried about something, you probably want to be worried about it too. It's inflation. And therefore, you want to be investing in asset classes that have proven to mitigate your exposure to inflation and also actually profit from it, which is what you do when you lock in debt at a certain dollar value that's gonna perform well over time for yourself. And then B, the dip for when you buy in real estate is when you buy at a certain price point with higher interest rates, because what's going to dip is the interest rate. And as the price continues to go up, you refinance there and you're locking that in.
Gosh, I like that. You like that, right? The change in the perspective of what does buying the dip mean in real estate? Dude, I think you're onto something there.
Right?
I like that.
I feel like I've been on a streak. Anyways, that being said, we're going to move on to the Dave Ramsey thing, but the place that you go to buy the dip right now in real estate is chatwithjwb.com. Folks here at JWB will be able to talk you through what it looks like to get into a property right now at these interest rates and what it looks like as it ages over time and you get to refinance and you get to lock in this equity for right now as the prices go up and then change your rate later. And I think this is a move that we are effectively recommending to people. So you go to chatwithjwb.com or like Cody put in the chat, you shoot an email to Cody@jwbcompanies.com.
Love it. You like well that? Done, brother. You like well that? Done.
I think we got some Q&A right here real quick.
Let's do it.
I think the first question was, did your hair get darker in Scotland?
Is that really a question?
I mean, that was a question in the chat. That was a question.
Really?
I feel like it's just getting longer.
My gray's still there. Yeah, don't worry,
still
guys.
Gray. Still gray.
Don't worry.
Don't worry.
Hey, man. There's no Just for Men going on here. I rock it loud and proud.
All right. Kathy Cepeda is saying, hey, guys, happy Tuesday. I have a question about tenants. I heard that there is chaos with tenants coming into rentals and not paying rent and not moving out. That's a question.
Okay. Well, Kathy, I love the question. Thank you for being here. I think I'll give kind of the big picture answer, which is this comes down to your choice for your team that's supporting your investments and specifically your property management team. So that's why when we talk about how to make an investment decision, most investors just make decisions on the property. What I recommend is starting with the team first and doing your due diligence on the team, that property management team specifically. Then when you find that team that you love, that is worthy of controlling and growing your funds for you, then you go to the market and you find the market they're operating in. Make sure that market makes sense. And then thirdly, you go to the property. So if you are seeing that or hearing that in your circles or in your personal experience, I would first look and see, do you have the right team supporting you? I can tell you within our organization, we absolutely do not see chaos with residents moving in, moving out, or anything along those lines. We collect 98% of rents. We have a lease renewal rate of over 80%, which I'm a little scared to share with you guys because I don't want you to hold us to that standard. That's the only time we've ever been at 80%, and there's no other property management company that I know of is anywhere near that.
But you're pretty accustomed to being at 70% plus.
Thank you, yes. 70% is where we've been for the last, call it 3, 4, 5 years. So we sign longer-term leases. We sign 2 and 3 year leases. And then when those leases come up for renewal, our residents are happy. And dare I say, 80% of them this year have chosen to renew. And ultimately what that does is it leads to a resident stay of 4.5 years on average at JWB. And the reason that impacts you is because you see lower maintenance and vacancy costs when your residents are happy and when they're in your home for 4.5 years. So, Kathy, I would encourage you to reach out to my team. It sounds like you have some properties or you're considering it. Reach out to my team and start to do your due diligence on the team. And I think you'll be in a good spot there.
That right there is what I call a golden nugget that we're going to clip out and post on the JWB YouTube channel. If you're on YouTube, check it out. And while you're at it, you may have noticed that this is being done live in front of an audience. If you want to be part of the show, go to nyais.com. That's Not Your Average Investor Show, nyais.com. Register and join us on a Tuesday or Thursday at 12:30 Eastern. Trust me, it's as fun as it sounds. Now let's get it back to me and GC kicking it with our Not Your Average Investor homies. Yeah, There you go, Kathy. I'm not sure if you're new to the show, Kathy, and if you are, we welcome you and we welcome questions like this. As we know, real estate, there is no national real estate market when it comes to renters and whatnot. What Greg is talking about is they operate 6,000 homes here in Jacksonville and they report on those numbers and they know their metrics. What I've learned as the newer investor here at the table is that not all teams are built the same. There's a lot of property management companies that don't even know that number. And most importantly, most property companies, what I've learned is they make the most money when they place a tenant, and therefore they are, whether they do it outwardly or just like inwardly, when you make the most money when you're replacing a tenant on tenant placement fees, which I believe you've said when you're buying property management companies, that's like 50-60% of the
25-50%.
I'm not the numbers guy.
There you go.
I'm the concept
Pablo
guy.
Pablo curve.
Yeah, the Pablo curve. So 25-50% of the revenue comes from that. What that means is that they are incentivized to like move people along, right? That's why they sign one-year leases and stuff like that. What I've seen at JWB in reporting from behind the scenes here for the last 4 years is that they really are trying to align with folks and understand those metrics that drive ROI for rental property investors. And this idea of like 80% renewals is not a coincidence, because it's not just that they're giving them a great experience and signing 2 and 3 year leases, but I've seen the training and how they talk to their residents, in the sense that the people that drive renewals are tactically reaching out way ahead of time to have the residents informed on like what it's going to cost them to move out or stay, and giving them those numbers. They're building that relationship throughout the year. And that's why people stay at JWB Homes and continue to pay. So, she's saying she's looking to start working with JWB.
All right, Kathy. Yeah. Wonderful. Looking forward to serving you.
So you might be hearing that that's based on other teams' performances in whatever market you're looking at, right? So I would just question the stats of where that's coming from and how they're driving those metrics.
Kathy, your name sounds really familiar. Let me know if we've met each other personally or in like a networking group. Your name sounds really familiar. So, and welcome to the show. It's really nice to have you.
Cool. Jim Kirko, Hall of Fame first baseman. Says, hello, gentlemen. It's your Hall of Fame first baseman here with my son who just finished his junior year at college. We love the Kirko family. I want to say you just hit a home run with your buy the dip analysis.
Yeah, man.
Let's go. I love the baseball analysis. But in baseball, buy the dip means grabbing your skull and placing a pinch in between your cheek and gums. Thanks for your guidance. Thank you, Jim, for bringing the baseball analogies.
Oh, that's good stuff.
Pedro Nacianceno says, I'm wondering, how is it that I seldom get a tenant maintenance request from my JWB properties compared to my non-JWB property, which seems to charge me once every couple of months? Not complaining, of course.
Well, you know, Pedro, that's how this is designed. We have taken a very strategic approach to how we have built our property management company so that we could create outcomes that are different than other property management companies. And then we've matched that with just a commitment to wonderful people being on this team who care deeply, who treat our residents like gold, right? And we understand that at the core of this investment model, we have to make sure we have great resident relationships. And so it's not a unique thing that you are not getting nickel and dimed. It's not a unique thing that you don't have a lot of maintenance requests. It's not a unique thing that things are just working well for you on the property management front with JWB. This is different. This is different than regular property management. And we started a long time ago and we just said, listen, if we can nail this experience for our owners, we can unlock this asset class for people like Pedro and for everybody here in the audience. And so, Pedro, thank you for that question and giving me the opportunity to kind of talk a little bit about that. But, you know, this is what investing in rental properties can be. But you don't have to be scared that you're going to get those late night phone calls or that you're going to get nickel and dimed, right? It can just work. It can just be easy. So thank you, buddy.
Thank you, Pedro. Listen, we have an awesome community. We got 84 people on right now. Pedro, we know that you're essentially giving us like a backhanded testimonial there, man. So
we appreciate
that. That happens so much on the show. I definitely want to encourage it more because it's great. But that's really awesome, Pedro. Thank you. And Kathy says, yeah, you met at Fortune Village.
Fantastic.
So you remember.
There you go.
Okay. So I just shared the article in the chat. We're going to dive into the topic du jour, Greg.
I love it.
That's the topic of the day, in case you were wondering. And it's this idea that even the Wall Street Journal is talking about it, right? There is this generational backlash against Dave Ramsey and Dave Ramsey's advice. And we are not here to throw shade at Dave Ramsey in any way. We're just here to talk about what's going on, because this kind of conversation is a conversation that is not foreign to us, because there are things that we want to detail out here of, like, why this is happening and why you don't throw away all the advice, but you also have to, like, learn to think for yourself, hence the name, Not Your Average Investor. Mm-hmm. So basically the article, I shared it in the chat if anybody wants to check it out, but they're talking about this idea that there is this generational pushback on Dave Ramsey. You go on TikTok, there is a ton of videos criticizing what Dave Ramsey says. And the younger generations, you know, they have a bit of a point, right? Like, they're talking about this idea that they've had unique economic challenges, unlike Dave Ramsey had growing up, and that maybe he's a little bit out of touch. They're talking about the fact that wages haven't really increased on par with pricing for our generation like it did with Dave Ramsey. For example, mm-hmm. I know that today I was talking to my niece. She's graduating college. She's really pumped about finding a job that pays 40 to 50 grand a year. Mm-hmm. That's what I was pumped to get mm-hmm. when I was coming out of college. Right. I had a job that was paying 48 grand a year, and I was really, really excited about it. And at the time, I could buy a home with that kind mm-hmm. of salary in Miami, which mm-hmm. I didn't do, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, nowadays, that's still a salary. Home prices have gotten completely different. Car prices are completely different, right? Mm-hmm. You could buy a Civic for $9,000 back mm-hmm. then too. Mm-hmm. Right? We're like, yeah. Now it's $22,000, right? They're talking about these economic challenges and what's happening. They're talking about these, like, real life financial decisions. Dave Ramsey seems to bring up a lot of this, like, you should just eat rice and beans and not buy $9 coffees. And they're really illustrating this idea that, hey, man, I get it. I make my own coffee. I'm doing these things. It's still not going to, like, defense my way all the way to, like, being able to build an empire like you did and buy a home and do these different types of things. They also have complaints about, like, the cultural and social sensitivity. We've learned a lot over the years as the internet has spread that not everybody is treated equal all mm-hmm. the time. Mm-hmm. And that also tends to handicap some folks. And at the end of the day, the big thing, if y'all don't know Dave Ramsey or you don't know what he's about, but it's this idea that Dave Ramsey villainizes debt. Mm-hmm. He basically says you should not ever have, you shouldn't be in any kind of debt whatsoever. And your job is to, before you do anything else, cut down on all of your expenses until you pay off any and all debt, including your student loans, including only getting maximum 15-year mortgages on a home. Mm-hmm. A piece of advice that I used to think that I needed to be doing, mm-hmm. by the way, mm-hmm. right? Like 15-year mortgages, not finance automobiles, not run credit card debt, right? So these changing attitudes towards debt for the younger generation are one part necessity and one part offense, right? Like, of what they need to do. So that's kind of what the article said. Greg, I know that you're not here to, like, crap on Dave Ramsey, but I do think that you have some places where you agree and some places where you agree with Dave Ramsey and his advice.
Yeah. Yeah. As I was reading through this article and doing a little bit more research, I can really understand the plight of the younger generation today. I mean, how can you not, you know? And I also understand how important it is to be able to speak to people on their own terms. And when you listen to Dave, Dave's way is the way, right? That's part of his appeal. He's no nonsense. He tells you like it is. But you can certainly understand how folks don't feel like he's speaking to them and or don't feel like he's speaking with them, right? And, you know, I think that there's a lot of good in Dave's advice. I think our country overall struggles when it comes to money management and discipline, and, like, deferred gratification is a very big part of his message. And you know, I think our country struggles with that overall. So I lean into that type of conversation.
Yeah.
But then there's certain parts where I'm like, man, if I had listened to Dave Ramsey, I would not be here today. Like, this company wouldn't be here today.
Say more about that. Just kind of, like, say what you mean by that.
Yeah, you know, to be able to start JWB, I had to really understand debt. There was no beginning of starting a real estate investment company without using debt, because I quickly realized the fundamentals of owning one property. And, you know, I worked really hard to be able to afford that down payment for that one property. But I realized that a business based on this, where I could do so much good in this world, would not be possible unless I could scale. And so debt became something of a tool for me that I knew I had to master, and that I could master, and that if I could master this, it's like any other tool in my entrepreneurial tool belt. And it was, it's not something to be villainized or demonized. It's not something to go completely 100% into without knowledge, because it absolutely can hurt people. Mm-hmm. But I knew that I needed to lean in and understand it and surround myself with people who were masters of debt as well. And by doing that, we were able to build an organization now that, you know, has bought and sold 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 homes now, and builds, you know, 400 properties a year. Each of those costs, you know, $200,000 to build. Mm-hmm. You know, the money to do that doesn't come from the bank of JWB. It's debt,
yep.
Right? We have debt relationships with all of you as private lenders of JWB. And then, of course, we have institutional relationships as well. So when I think about myself, I think as a young person, understanding some of the fundamentals of what Dave is talking about is critical.
Yep.
Deferred gratification is one of the things my dad talked to me about so much growing up. And I hear a lot of that in what Dave's message is, and I love that. But where I, you know, I just can't relate to Dave when he talks about how debt is the villain and debt is bad and that debt should be avoided at all costs, because I've lived a different reality and I've seen not just what I can do when I take the time to master debt, but I see what, you know, 1,800 clients are doing,
yeah,
and how their lives have been changed. I mean, we've been able to create millionaires just by folks understanding using debt to their advantage within their turnkey rental portfolios and the private lending dollars that we've been able to return to folks. And through those millionaires, they've been able to do wonderful things in their community. And JWB is, you know, we're on the verge of donating our 6th home to a member of this community. It's going to be a JWB resident. You know, so it's hard for me to just lean in and say that, you know, that is good advice when it comes to demonizing debt. It's not been my reality.
Yeah, and I think just like you can't paint a generation with a broad brush and just say that these are $9 latte drinking entitled kids, you also can't paint Dave with a broad brush.
Yeah.
We're getting a decent amount of feedback from our community, which is true. Dave has basically lived his life, and his learned experience has been he took out debt irresponsibly and he paid the price, right? And therefore, he thinks that the thing that is most useful for folks is to go out there and villainize debt so that people don't get into that same problem. For us, we take a slightly different approach. We haven't built as giant a media empire as Dave Ramsey has built, but we villainize lack of education.
Mm-hmm.
And we really promote nuance and really understanding what you're getting into and what you're getting out of and what you can get out of it and what are the hurdles, right? That is why we put together the Not Your Average Investor's Guide to Passive Investing, where we talk about all the different things that could kill your cash flow and like hurt your appreciation and hurt your experience in a passive rental property environment. And I think that this is the opportunity to go in and just like, instead of like the Fed is doing, using a blunt instrument to either bash Dave or not bash Dave, let's take a scalpel and just kind of like talk about what is true and what isn't.
Mm-hmm.
I think the first thing that I would talk about is these like economic challenges that younger generations are really facing. This idea that they have faced stagnant wages for a very, very long time while costs have continued to rise. And whether or not debt is a good instrument or stay away from debt when it comes to that. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's real. It is so much harder today to start your home ownership journey and your real estate portfolio journey today than it was when I started 18 years ago, and definitely when Dave started,
yeah,
back in the day. So that I totally understand. It's just real. How do you shake it any other way other than it's much harder today because wages have not risen at the pace of, you know, home price and rent prices as far as what they've risen. To me, there's a fundamental miss here, though. And this is something that I would differ on with Dave. It's that, you know, what I quickly understood at age 23, and it was like this light bulb went off for me. It was like, you know, my job, if I am trying to set myself up, my future self, 5, 10, 20 years down the road, my job at that moment at 23 was not to make the most money today. My job was to build an army of income-producing assets that got better with time.
Mm.
And that's why I fell in love with single-family rental properties, because there was not many barriers to entry. You could use debt to acquire these assets, and they paid for themselves. Mm-hmm. And I just realized, and we've done numerous shows on this, that when you can buy one property at whatever age, the younger you are, and just continue to add to that on a regular routine, maybe that's one a year, maybe that's one every 2 years, what you're doing is you'll wake up in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, and you'll look back and you'll see home price appreciation, you'll see more cash flow, cash growth portfolio. We talk a lot about that. Your tax savings will get bigger and bigger and bigger every single year. Your principal pay down gets better and better and better every single year. It's like a fine wine. It gets better with time. Mm-hmm. And so your job, that works with one property. But if you can start as young as possible and fill that portfolio and then just let it do what it does, you're going to set yourself up for a positional financial strength when you need it down the road. So debt is the only way to do that unless you have this rich family, right? Yeah. But like most of us don't, right? So debt and mastering debt became one of the most important things for me personally if I wanted to build this army of income-producing assets. So knowing that wages have not kept up with home prices and that it's much harder today because of that, the value of understanding and mastering smart debt is even more important to me today, mm-hmm. because that is how you can still get your real estate portfolio started even at a young age. So I think it's totally right, but you know, Dave and I wouldn't agree on this. He would say stay away from debt. I'm thinking mastering smart debt, putting the work in to truly understand it is even more important today than when Dave started many years ago.
Yeah. You know, just like Dave draws on his own life experience of getting into a whole bunch of trouble with debt and therefore villainizing it, to me, this one hits me at my core because I think that I'd made the same mistake. And I thought to myself, you know what? I'm never going to buy another a property unless I can get a 15-year mortgage and unless I can bring like 20 to 50% down to the table or whatnot. And what I've noticed is that I missed out on a whole lot of appreciation, a whole lot of options that I would have today if I hadn't been seated with that thought in my head of I should wait to buy real estate instead of buy real estate and wait.
Yeah.
And that's why to me, when somebody told me that axiom, don't wait to buy real estate and wait, I've brought that up a lot because I think what people miss is the idea that, yeah, listen, it's great. If you can buy real estate that cash flows a certain amount today, more power to you, mm-hmm. right? But if you don't get confused with the fact that like cash flow today is not the same as cash flow tomorrow. And as this asset matures over time, it gives you more and more options over time from a refinancing standpoint, from a 1031 standpoint, from all these different things that you can do by having like the amount of equity that this thing creates for you by allowing it to pay for itself over time and then being able to leverage that equity in your own favor. To me, that's the thing that people are really missing, especially now, especially in this like high price, high interest rate environment. They're thinking about, man, when can I get in when the condition is optimal for today? When the idea is like, how soon can you get in while the condition is doable for you that doesn't put you in a precarious situation so that this stuff can start to compound for you over time?
Mm-hmm.
So in that regard, I have a real issue with this idea of like, hey, stop, wait till you have $200,000 saved up instead of like the decision that I made, which was I had certain amounts saved up that if I were to buy a house, I wouldn't be buying the house that I really wanted to live in. I would, if I did want to buy the house I wanted to live in, I'd be really, really stretched, or I could take that money and put it into a rental property that's immediately paying for itself 4 years ago. And I sit here today, the beneficiary of having stacked those chips, and I've been able to buy my own house now because I've been able to like do that stuff. Right. So to me, this is one of the big, big misses. This idea that stagnant wages versus rising costs, and then telling in the face of that advice, well, you're just going to have to cut down so much that you can save enough to get into the real estate asset that you want. that's Aaron. Like, I think like you gotta get into real estate as soon as possible because it's the only thing that's going to protect you from stagnant wages and rising costs.
I'll give some real numbers, your real numbers, if it's okay with you, right? Sure. I was looking at your client ROI report yesterday, and there's $90,000 of gains that you've been able to make in your portfolio. That's and if you had listened to Dave's advice and only bought that property with cash or that 15-year, you wouldn't have bought property number one.
Yeah.
Right? And that $90,000 is a lot more than what would have been accomplished if you were putting it into another asset 100%. Class as well. Yeah. So there's a real-life example. It's understandable why you don't agree.
Yep, exactly. So let's go into the next one, right? So the next one is this idea that they're talking about. They have these real-life financial decisions. They have practical needs versus Dave Ramsey's advice. Dave is saying, you know, eat rice and beans only. Don't buy $9 coffees. Take a bike for 50 miles instead of like having a car or whatnot. Do you think debt plays into this decision?
I was thinking more of just like consumer spending. That's where my head was going into this. Do I think debt plays into this decision? Yeah, I think debt definitely plays into this decision overall. Dave's advice is just no debt, no debt, no debt, mm-hmm. because he wants max cash flow. Right? He is looking for a way to help our country become financially strong. And, you know, the reality is most people in our country are not listening to the show. Most people in our country have a struggle to become average when it comes to money management. And so I think when Dave's talking about debt and how he's villainizing debt, a lot of times he's talking about credit card debt and taking out debt for things that you can't afford that don't go up in value.
Yeah.
You know, my definition of smart debt is taking debt on something that pays for itself every single month, yep. that is not expensive. And guess what? 7%, 8% for debt is not expensive when you're making 10, 12, sometimes 15, 20% as our clients have made over the years. So 7, 8% is not expensive debt, especially when it's fixed rate. Mm-hmm. And then number three, take out debt on an asset that goes up in value over time. I think what Dave's talking about with debt and what he's villainizing mainly is the debt that you take out credit cards to go and buy a big screen TV or take out debt to go and go on vacation. So that being said, he still does not propose taking out debt on real estate, and that's where we differ.
Yeah.
So anyways, practical needs. Like, I really like the message here of living within your means.
I do too, man.
Right? That's a message that does not land well in our country overall, but I wish it would more. So I really do lean into that. I don't think there's anything wrong with just deferred gratification. Like, I know there's something to be said for if you can't afford it, yep. right? Living within your means. He talks about rice and beans all the time. I have no problem with eating rice and beans. If all I can do is afford to eat rice and beans without taking out debt on going and buying big screen TVs, I'm going to eat some rice and beans until I can afford, you know, something else. So I really do like that advice.
I do too. I definitely believe in living within your means. To me, when I think about this, it's like, hey, if I live in California, then I probably want to invest in real estate in Jacksonville. I face that decision, right? Like, I'm living in Miami and I'm thinking, how can I get to a point where I can afford a home and invest in real estate? I look to Jacksonville. I look to a lower price market where I can not have to sit down and play at the $500 Bellagio craps table. I can play at the $5 table in a game that is actually not rigged against me, you know? So I think of this idea of living within your means and practical needs as you can definitely look for places to reduce your cost of living.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, leaving Miami to come to Jacksonville to me was crazy to people in my circle,
mm-hmm.
but I knew that I was going to have a really, really hard time building up a solid financial base in Miami where everything costs twice as much as Jacksonville. And I'm surrounded by people that all they ever do is glorify BMWs and Ferraris and Maseratis. So while I'm able to defend that myself, there's still enough that it's a drag on me, you know? So
interesting.
To me, the idea of looking where you can live within your means is if you're just getting started living in a super high price city where wages don't really keep up with it, you probably want to move to somewhere like a Jacksonville. If you are somebody that is making a good living in a place like Northern California, but you can't afford a home, investing in a property in Jacksonville, that makes a lot of sense living within your means. I very much believe in this idea of don't be putting $9 coffees on your credit card that you can't pay down every single month. Make your own Folgers at home or however you want to do it. But I think there is also the other side of the scalpel here, where it's you can't play defense your whole life. At some point, you need to carve out a little space for offense. Mm-hmm. You need to live within your means as much as possible playing defense in a way that you can still have 1%, 2%, 3%, 5% of whatever you're doing, no matter how young you are, to be putting into the offense side of your portfolio, the offense side of where you're, you know, like your future and stuff like that, right? So like, yep. I think you can only retreat so much. You can't cut costs yourself to a $1 billion company.
Exactly.
Just like you can't cut costs yourself to actually building an attractive portfolio for you that you're going to be able to retire on later.
I love it. It's a nuanced message for me, right? It starts out with live within your means, because I think that's the baseline. I think that's great advice for everybody. But expand your means, mm-hmm. right? Expand your means through knowledge, education, relationships. Debt is a great way to expand your means when used appropriately. And that's kind of the place that Dave would probably not go to.
Yeah, there you go. All right. And then last but not least, it's Dave's debt management philosophy, where he promotes this like debt snowball method mm-hmm. of paying off your lowest balance off first mm-hmm. in whatever you have debt in, and then moving on, instead of thinking about paying off your lowest interest rate or versus, you know, it's the idea of you're paying down balance versus interest rate.
Mm-hmm.
And people, financial advisors have like fought back on that, mm-hmm. that's not a good idea. What do you say about that?
I love Dave's approach here. Yeah. I mean, it sounds really similar to the C3X model, yeah. which we've showcased on the show multiple times. And if anybody would like to sit down with my team and talk about the C3X model, which is the compound cash flow calculator model, which basically takes your mortgages that you have on your rental properties, and we're able to show you how you pay those things off strategically and pay them off faster. You know that we love this debt snowball method that Dave talks about. So I love it. What Dave is talking about is he uses this to eliminate all debt. So he uses this to eliminate consumer debt, right? Credit card debt and things of that nature. So what he does is he says, okay, well, these are all of your credit cards. This is all the debt that you have out there. Most people don't have real estate mortgage debt like we're talking about here. So he's talking about everything else. And he's like, his contrarian view is focus on the debt with the lowest payment first, because it doesn't matter what the interest rate is. Focus on the debt with the lowest payment first. And he wants you to attack that. And the reason is because when you attack that, it gets paid off quicker. And let's just say that that's $400 a month of that debt right there. Well, once you pay that off, that's another $400 that you now snowball onto the next highest debt number. And so focusing on that lowest payment rather than lowest interest rate is the contrarian idea that that Dave has. And I love it, especially in real estate. That's the same methodology we use to help our clients pay off their debt. Now, what's interesting is that if I'm only thinking about my return on investment, the C3X model or the debt snowball method or whatever you want to call it, when JWB is recommending to clients to do that, it's actually not the best return on their investment. Because if they have an interest rate on their mortgage that's 5%, what they're doing is they're paying off, they're using their money and earning 5% on it, but because they're paying off a 5% debt. We know JWB has assets that we sell every day that, you know, earn 9%, 10%. So it's actually not the best return on investment methodology, but I don't care. Like, I'm looking holistically what's best for that client. And for many folks, it's not one size fits all, but for many folks, eliminating that debt on their properties after they have their portfolio built, eliminating that debt on their properties sets them up to have the right amount of income that they need as they get towards retirement or whatever life milestone they have. So yeah, so I'm totally on board with Dave here. I think this is great, and I wish more people would do it.
Are there moments where it makes more sense to pay down the high interest rate thing versus the low balance thing?
You know, financially, from a return on investment perspective, it would actually make more sense to do the high interest rate mm-hmm. because you're actually earning a higher return on your money yep. when you're paying off a higher interest rate.
True.
So if cash flow is not a concern for you mm-hmm. and you're not trying to get out of debt, then paying the highest interest rate would actually make financial sense. Where Dave is coming from here is that most people are struggling to get out of debt.
Yeah.
And so there's a component in the, even though it might not be the best return on investment, in real life, it's better to pay off the lowest. For one, because you're paying those debts off, you're freeing up more cash flow, which is what they really need sooner. And then there's just a experience of it. Like a lot of this is like staying in the game and paying off that debt until you get to the finish line. And most people fail there. So like seeing those wins, seeing that debt get paid off and it going from $400 a month to paying that off to now $800 to the next debt, there's a psychological component, which he likes. On the rental property side, it's the same thing. If you really wanted the best return on investment, you would probably just do a different asset. You'd invest in a different asset rather than paying the debt off at all. Middle ground would be you would pay the highest interest rate debt off of if you're truly going for a better return on your investment. But for most people, you get a portfolio of 3, 5, 10, 20 properties. You got that set with JWB. And the next thing you're thinking of is 5 years, 10 years, 15 years down the road, what income am I going to have when these things are paid off? So again, you're in income accumulation mode there. Yeah. And that's why we would recommend the debt snowball, as Dave would call it, or C3X, as we call it.
Good stuff. So we're not that far off.
I think it's great.
Like, I think, you know, we led this thing. It would have been really, really easy to just bash Dave Ramsey for villainizing debt because, as we know, as real estate investors, we use smart debt to build wealth. But at the end of the day, I think the villain is not debt. The villain is lack of education.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we wanted to take this nuanced approach, talk about it from what this backlash is, why people are backlashing. And at the end of the day, you know, what resonates the most to me is that this might be a generational backlash against Dave Ramsey, but I think that this is not very unsimilar. Like, this advice that he's giving, I think is just like something that is out there, right? And therefore, when I'm trying to tell my friends what I'm doing, investing in real estate and growing this portfolio, and this idea that, cool, yeah, you can be investing in the stock market at these like 6-7% returns or whatever the returns are. You can keep continue doing whatever you're doing. I'm choosing this different approach because I don't want to be most vulnerable at my most vulnerable later in life. Mm-hmm. I want to create this army of income producing properties.
Can you say that one more time? Vulnerable thing.
Yeah. I what I've seen is a big moment for me was a couple of years ago when I was trying to work with my dad in order to expand my real estate portfolio. My dad's in retirement. He's done very, very well his whole life. And as we were going into, I think it was like early 2021, maybe like mid 2022, when like the stock market had taken this dip, he told me, hey, this isn't really the best time because my cash flow is compressed right now because the stock market is doing XYZ. And that's when the thing that really, really hit me was this idea that this philosophy of that ING made so popular in their commercials of like, what's your number? This philosophy of getting to a certain number so that you can then put that number somewhere and siphon cash flow from that number sets up a retirement that makes you then be beholden to whatever is happening in the market and being able to like live off the cash flow that this can produce in a volatile asset that goes up and down during recessionary times. And when I compare that to the idea of instead having 40, 50, 60 rental properties, right? Even 20 rental properties and like one being not rented at a time, that percentage of cash flow that I don't have coming in that I don't live by, that I don't get to spend my money on, right? Like when I don't want to be making money at the time, when I'm not in my active income creating time,
mm-hmm.
that feels like a situation where not only is my cash flow more stable, but also what we talked about, this idea that I can refinance, this idea that like Ken Molina, I can take a reverse mortgage. It gives me more options while that number that I had saved up for, I'm now going to get advice of saying, you can't touch that thing. Now you can't be risky with that money. You can't continue to grow that. So what I noticed was that if you are living your life by this idea of saving up enough money to then live off of, that is invested in assets that go up and down while you're in retirement, you are more vulnerable at the time in your life when you no longer want to be working on your active income, when you just want to be living your life in retirement, when you're at your most vulnerable. So I see, I don't know, I feel like I've rambled on a little bit, but like,
it's good, man.
I think that if you build a portfolio of rental income properties, then you stand a position of power at your most vulnerable. When you're older, when you don't have the energy to work, you don't want to be doing it. You don't want to be out there taking on side jobs. Whereas if I'm just beholden to like having something in a very liquid asset that goes up and down much more forcefully, I think I'm going to live longer. I don't think that I'm going to retire at 68 and like only live to 80. I think there's a really high chance that people of our age live to about 100. And I don't want to be more vulnerable when I'm in my most vulnerable.
You've said a couple of things here on this show that are just like I just immediately related to.
Yeah.
They struck a chord for me. And they're great hot takes, by the way. Buy the dip and, you know, invest in real estate so you're not vulnerable when you're most vulnerable.
Yeah.
You know?
I agree, Matt. By the way, Jim Kirko agrees. He says his takeaways from the show are buy the dip, understanding that this is a different philosophy for real estate. And two, you cannot defense your way to financial freedom. And says, thanks, guy. I love today's session.
We love you too, Jim, and your son. It's awesome you guys watch the show together, man.
Love having you. All right. So I think that's it, right?
It's a great time.
If you don't want to be most vulnerable, you're most vulnerable. Start building that income-producing portfolio of assets in real estate with JWB. It's a great option. Go to chatwithjwb.com. Shoot Cody an email at cody@jwbcompanies.com. She can help you through that. Start that conversation so that you're not just trying to catch up later on in life. Anything else, JC? What do we got coming up next week, man?
I didn't take a look, actually. You know what I do now. I just show up like 5 minutes before.
You just
show
up. Are we unveiling a new tool next week?
Are we?
Is that what's happening?
Let's check the dates. Let's see. I know. Is that?
No. I think we're probably going to do some more of these Not Your Average Insights next week.
Well, I don't know. Well, you got to show up and find out. I'm not quite sure.
Had a great audience today. Had some great names that we don't see all the time. Kelly came back. I hadn't seen her in a while. By the way, Sergio Prieto out there. Go Gators.
Go Gators.
Says GC is now Gray Cohen. Looking good.
That's apropos.
Yeah. We had Kelly come back. Good to see you, Kelly. We saw Jim on the show. We had some new friends today that pitched in. Your friend from Fortune Builders was here.
Oh, yeah. Kathy Cepeda.
Yeah, Kathy Cepeda. We really can't do this show without you. The fact that you all show up here, take an hour of your day on Tuesdays to spend time with us, add texture to the show, create better questions and context, and give us this feedback of like what really, really resonates to help us help more people through education is what this thing is all about. Hope to see you next Tuesday. Until then, do you see any little pieces of advice?
Don't be average.
See you next week.
See you.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate you listening to this podcast. Sending one of these episodes to a buddy or dropping us a review would be awesome. But what I really want you to do is go to nyais.com, register, and join us live on a Tuesday or Thursday. Seriously, when are you going to do it? When are you going to be the next Lee, the next Jen, the next Nadim, the next Ken, the next Marilyn Cotterman from Homosassa, Florida, the next Hervé Francois, so I can butcher your name for a while and then become your buddy, the next Bill Shields to come up with a hilarious new way to introduce yourself every time I do the roll call. You get the point. We got a bunch of amazing folks. We want you to be a part of it. Join us live on the show. Go to nyais.com. Register, join us at least one Tuesday or one Thursday a month at 12:30. I promise it's as fun as it sounds. Hope to see you on the show. I promise you will not be treated like an average investor.